That. All right. At this time, I'd like to introduce tonight's speaker. I've known him for a few years, and he comes from the Friends of Bill W. home group out in Suffolk. Please join me now in sending a warm welcome to Jim.
Okay, this is my maiden voyage, so, you know, beginning of Memorial Day weekend, beginning of the summer, I can certainly remember, and I'm sure a lot of you all, for myself, 5 or 6 years ago in my heyday when I was drinking heavily, the beginning of Memorial Day weekend, a hard week. Friday, and wow, it was off exciting, you know, off Friday, and then we had the holiday Monday, so, you know, instead of having to wind down on Sunday afternoon and get ready for Monday, man, we could keep it going on Friday, Saturday, and Sunday, no breaks, and it was great, wasn't it? And who would think, or I would never thought that I'd be here on a Friday evening, Memorial Day weekend. You know, my sponsor told me, Jim, this is going to be exhilarating. So I thought, you know, do you remember when Busch Gardens came to town, I don't know how many years ago, and they had the Loch Ness Monster, you know, and it was like, okay, we're past the little things on Ocean View, the little roller coasters on Ocean View and Buckrow Beach. Now we got this thing in Williamsburg to look forward to. And it's like, you know, first time here for me going up, and I bet the most people have been on Loch Ness Monster in here, going up that ramp and then being at the top and going down. And this is kind of what it's like here, you know, standing right here in front of you guys and women. And so we'll let it go here and see how we do. So I'll do the best I can, be as transparent as I can. I think I'm one of the older guys in here. I've got 71 years to kind of regress and go over my past with you guys. There is a disclaimer now. My sponsor told me now, you have to remember that you're speaking to Into Action AA group. You're not down at St. Mary's Catholic Church in Suffolk where I go, and you're not speaking to them, nor are you listening. So let's keep, you know, it's a spiritual program. But there is a disclaimer I will have to tell you. I grew up Catholic, raised Catholic. My higher power is Jesus Christ, and that's it. I'm not going to spout off a lot of scriptures and psalms and numbers and things like that. So anyway, that's where I am with that. There will be some reference to that, but we'll keep it to the relevance of the program. How I got here. Two words I want to start with for you all, and I want you to think about while I'm speaking. It's two words here, and it came to mind. One is metamorphosis, okay? The process of transformation from an immature form to an adult form, from immature insect to a mature insect, the caterpillar to the butterfly. We know about that, certainly. A change of the form of nature of a thing or person into a completely different one by natural or supernatural means. Metamorphosis is essentially the start of change, a striking alteration in appearance, character, or circumstances. The other one is a Greek word called metanoia, which is changing one's mind, the process of experiencing a psychotic breakdown and subsequent positive psychological rebuilding or healing. Also, it's a change in one's life resulting from penance, or a spiritual conversion. So the next few minutes, I'll try and develop these a little bit. I want you to think about it, maybe how maybe these two words in your life, in your journey of Alcoholics Anonymous, how maybe some of these two words are maybe relevant in your life and in your program. I'll try and break down my story certainly in four parts, by my early childhood, adolescent, early adult, middle age, and then where I am now, old geezer. So I'll try and show the relevance to alcohol in my recovery program in each one of those parts. I was born in Richmond, Virginia. Started with, of course, my father was from Harrisonburg, Virginia, and my mother was from Brooklyn, New York. They met during World War II. Father in the Brooklyn shipyard. He was a pharmacy mate. After the war, got married. My father went to pharmacy school, Medical College of Virginia in Richmond. I was unfortunately. My father and mother got divorced at two when I was 2 years old, so he was gone. So my exposure to my father was at, if I remember, 5, 6 years old, was on Sunday after church, after I had one sister 5 years older than I. After church, my mother would take. My father had a drugstore on the on West Broad Street. If you know anything about Richmond, West Broad Street near the TB Tower. Anyway, that's where he had. Actually, it was a little bit. He was by himself first, and then he went into with his uncle, who was also a pharmacist. They had pharmacy on West Broad Street. So my exposure to my father was basically. Sundays after church, and then of course he might come over during the week sometime for a short visit, and then maybe on the holidays he would come. So that was my exposure. I know that it was to run in on Sunday, and it was like, of course, it was the kid in the candy store, you know, had the candy, he had the old soda fountain there, and the and gosh, it was great, but it was only a very short thing. And, it was really difficult because I adored my father. He was a kind and gentle man, and, he was an alcoholic. But of course, I knew nothing about that or knew anything about the disease. Of course, I was just a little kid. So, but the where I first saw this was, we did have times when we would go back to Harrisonburg to visit. He was one of eight children. He was the youngest, and I can remember, of course, with all the sisters and brothers getting together and the relatives, and they would have a big get together, big card game, and their alcohol was flowing. And my father, he was an Old Crow man, and he just loved that Old Crow bourbon. And I just never thought anything about the disease at all. I thought it was a little strange, though, that he always walked around with like a half pint of Old Crow in his pocket, you know, and he's always taking a swig of that thing. So anyway, as I, it was it was a little tough for me. You know, all my little friends, they all had the typical mother-father relationship at home. And I was, you know, I was, of course, my father and mother, which back in the, you know, at that time in the 50s, was not something you just didn't see a lot of. And so, you know, I know that I tried to hide it at times. You know, one of my mother had a friend of hers over, and you know, he would come out the door and say, "Jimmy, come here." And my little friend would say, "Who's that?" I said, "Well, that's my father." So I was just, you know, it was really difficult for me to accept that my father and that they were divorced. About the, I guess it was eighth grade, my father and mother, my mother and sister and I had to move. We had to move further east, about 4 or 5 miles. We grew up in the west end of Richmond, near the University of Richmond, if you know anything about that, Free Chop Patterson area. So we moved further east, about 4 or 5 miles, not far at all, but it was like, you know, I was leaving my little friends, and I had to, you know, it's like I was moving to the other side of the world to leave my little friends. But one thing it did give me was I was very close to my father's drugstore now. I could just ride my bicycle. It took me about 10, 15 minutes to get to the store now. And then I started to actually become involved in the store. I spent lots of time the whole summer. I was there the whole time. After school, I went to, you know, I was in Thomas Jefferson High School, so that was only a stone's throw away from where my father's store was on West Broad Street. You know, I spent, I would go over there after school and spend an evening and do my homework there on the counter, you know, the whole works. But I learned everything about, you know, running a drugstore. I could, you know, do everything. I ran the soda fountain. I could fill prescriptions. I could do the accounts receivable. And so anyway, it enabled me to have the relationship with my father that I didn't have earlier. So certainly, but then I saw, you know, he was, seemed to be drinking more and more. This was, I was probably in, I guess, 10th grade. And, you know, I could, he was, had his bottle of Old Crow back and stashed away in the side where the medications were, kept the medications, and he was always going over there and taking a hit of the alcohol, of the Old Crow. And, you know, by the end of the evening, he was pretty well hammered there, you know. And some of his friends, of his best friends, included the captain of the vice squad of Richmond, Bales Bondman, and there was a fellow that ran a store downtown Richmond. I don't know what you would call it. He sold all kinds of incense, candles, barber supplies. That was the name of the place. It was a barber supply store, but he did all kinds of stuff. And I can remember going down there at nighttime after we closed the store and playing craps and the alcohol flowing and, you know, it was just all kinds of stuff going on. So anyway, I saw the alcoholism in full glory of my father. And I was about 10, 15 years old. And one Sunday morning, December 4th, 1966, we were there in the store, and my father just kind of, something happened. I don't know whether he had a stroke, hepatic coma, was just non-responsive. Laying on, just slumped over on the counter, wouldn't go to the hospital. Anyway, he got a little bit better during the day. The next day, Monday, he didn't go to work, which he hadn't missed work in God knows how long. And then Tuesday, December 6, 1966, he passed away. That was the last time I saw him. And I was devastated. My world had just about ended. Or had ended, but it was devastating. So after that, my so had to cope with that, and I just kind of languished in school. I just had no focus, no motivation, even though I wanted to go. I wanted to be a pharmacist just like him, and that was my goal, but you know, I didn't care. It was my goal, or I had wanted to, you know, go to pharmacy school, be a pharmacist, and then maybe I could come back and run and work with him in the store. Of course, that didn't work. At that time, also, the large retail pharmacies were starting to take the little corner drugstores over, and the day of the, you know, the small retail pharmacy was going by the way. So anyway, fortunately, the light bulb went on about the late when I was a junior in high school. I started doing a little bit better in school. And my mother met this fellow, and he was spending a lot of time at the house, I noticed that every time he came over, he brought a bottle of bourbon. And anyway, 4 days before my graduation in high school, Thomas Jefferson, they were in bed, they were smoking and drinking, place caught on fire, house department caught on fire, my mother was burned probably close to 40% of her body, third degrees burns. Now, if you knew anything about burn therapy back in the 60s, it was very limited as far as the treatment that they could do. So my mother laid in a hospital in Richmond for almost 3 months. I was the only person that I had at my graduation was this fellow who was had become well, he was all I had basically back then. So we, of course, the apartment was destroyed. We had to move to another third story flat on Gray Street. And I was there for, you know, and living with this man until finally my mother, they finally did a skin graft on my mother, and she pulled through. So she came through that. But this man, he was an alcoholic, and my mother and him, they ended up getting married, so we ended up getting another place and living, so this man was very violent. He was he would come home with the bottle of, I forget, Evan Williams, I think, and it was just bam, and then pass out, and then when he woke up, it was he was ready for rampage. Okay, and so I got to get rolling here. But anyway, so it was just horrible. It was 3 years of living in hell with this man. So finally, I was gotten into Virginia Commonwealth University 2 years. And then worked in a grocery store to help. So I was not drinking. I was not doing anything as far as drinking. I mean, my drinking had not taken off. And so I didn't have time. I was trying, and like I said, my goal was to get into pharmacy school. After 2 years, I did. I got into Virginia Medical College of Virginia Pharmacy School, class of 1974. Worked as hard as I could. Still working in this grocery store while I was going to pharmacy school. Anyway, I got out. Of course, I graduated, and since my father died, I didn't have the desire to go into pharmacy. So I decided, you know what, I wanted to go to medical school, but I wasn't smart enough to get into medical school. So I said, maybe I can get into dental school. So I did, applied to dental school, and I got in, Medical College of Virginia, class of 78. And then again, it was 4 years of that. I just did not, I didn't have any time. All I did was went to, it was time. It was consuming. I had no time to go drinking, partying, anything like that. At that time, junior year, I met a girl that was in pharmacy school, and we got married. Finished 78, like I said, we married that my senior year. I got a position with the United States Coast Guard in the support center in Portsmouth, there was two dentists, myself, the senior dental officer, and another 4 years. You'd have the parties on if you're in the military, you'd have some parties here and there, but it was some, basic drinking on Friday afternoon, some beer, nothing, anything. So anyway, my point is I was hardly doing any drinking at all. 70, and so I was in the Coast Guard 5 years. He wanted me to go to Mobile, Alabama. I didn't want to go, so I got out. And I was looking for a place in private practice, and my friend here, his brother, helped me find a position locally with one of the dentists here, and started there. So was there a couple of years, and unfortunately I got involved with one of the girls in the office, which is, can't do that. Anyway, ended up getting divorced. And I was free and loose for about 5-6 years, working hard. And after about 6 years or so being single, then I met another girl. She was the sister of my best friend's hygienist in Richmond. My best friend in dental school, his hygienist, his sister. I met her. And we got married, and then it took off from there. My partner had introduced me to scotch, and that was like, wow, that was the greatest thing. I mean, a little scotch and some ice and some water, and boy, that was, the days of just drinking a couple of cold beers, that was over with. So I knew the world of scotch, I forgot to say that one of my passion was when I was growing up was as a kid was baseball. In Richmond was the Yankees farm team was the Richmond Virginians, and I would go to. I mean, I just went to virtually every game. A lot of times the teams from North would come down and play an exhibition. The Yankees had come through, and in those old parks, you had to actually walk from the concourse to get to the field. So everybody was, and there was Mickey Mantle, and I'd gotten his autograph about 5 times. He said, "Kid, get out of here. I'm not signing your autograph anymore." But little did I know that, Mickey Mantle, if you know anything about that, he was a raging alcoholic. But the two people that I idolized so much, my father and Mickey Mantle, would die of alcoholism. I forgot to interject that. I didn't first say that earlier. Anyway, I'm in the, I got to get rolling here. We got a little bit of time. We're doing good. My sponsor back there is giving me the. I want to guess the good part's coming up. My wife was an artist, and she was taking classes up in Baltimore and for most of the summer. So I hatched this idea. We had a detached garage, and I hatched this idea that I was going to make it a sports bar. And I was going to take all my memorabilia that I had from when I was a little kid and make a shrine to the New York Yankees. And I had been to fantasy camp. I've done fantasy camp started in 99 and did it 13 years in a row. So I had accumulated a lot of a lot of memorabilia. These guys that I idolized when I was a little kid back in the 60s, these are guys that they're your coaches when you're playing. So it was really quite an experience. Anyway, I hatched this idea and I built this shrine to the New York Yankees sports bar. It was quite a place. And anyway, that's where it started going downhill. I got involved, had another affair. And that's where I got in trouble. I had an affair. And then I knew I was drinking way too much, and I decided to go to a rehab facility in Maryland, Maryland, on the banks of the Chesapeake Bay. It was a beautiful place, but I wasn't there because I thought I was just drinking a little bit too much and I needed to slow down. I didn't accept the program at all of AA, and so I got out. After 30 days, I went to one meeting a week, and that was difficult. And so after I was sober for about 5 months, and said, you know what, I got this. And of course, complacency set in, and I started drinking again, and then just went downhill again. So that was in 2010. So we fast forward, and I'm working hard, you know, dentistry, my practice going well, but sitting in this Yankee room, we called it, and just isolating, drinking, internet gambling, chasing women, just the whole works. And you know, I was a mess. And so finally, 2016, we start coming, my partner, after I guess we had 15, almost 31 years, partner says that he didn't want to be in a partnership anymore. So we split. So we had two offices at the time. I took this one office in Chesapeake that we had, and I was it. You know, I was the big guy then. You know, I had to, for all these years, I always had an office manager or my partner's wife to, you know, to run things, take things. All I had to do was do dentistry, and I didn't have to worry about all this other nonsense with 15 females, and I didn't have to worry. But now I was it. I had five women working for me, and they just they led the lamb to slaughter. I just couldn't handle it. They took over. It was the tail wagging the dog instead of the dog wagging the tail. And I turned to alcohol. I got one time became hospitalized, alcoholic hepatitis, and this was in year 2017. So, you know, I was, and then just kept going, getting worse. And then there was, I had gotten into, the scotch, or, you know, whatever it was, whether it be, you know, half a liter of scotch a night. I'd gotten into some Xanax and Ambien. And then I could only get, you know, my physician had prescribed a certain amount, so I got another, I found a way to obtain Xanax, and it was from a guy out in Nepal, India. And so that was crazy. And then you can't get rid of these guys. I couldn't, even after I got sober, you couldn't get rid of these guys. I kept telling, you know, I would tell them, Jim is dead, Jim, or I would tell them I was a DEA agent. I would tell them, you can't. And they would keep calling. It was just like, you could never get rid of this guy. The block is a number. Anyway, I couldn't get rid of this guy. And so then there was a fateful day in August, and this is 2017. Had a patient, a big guy, and I was taking out an upper wisdom tooth, and as I was taking it out, part of the bone around it fractured, and he started bleeding, and which is not an uncommon occurrence at all. It happens. It does happen a lot, and or frequently, and I could not stop the bleeding. And so, as hard as I tried, I had to call EMT. They'd come, take him to the hospital. So, of course, they took him to the hospital and everything, and they stopped the bleeding. He was fine afterwards. But I had to file a claim with my insurance company if something happens. That's what you have to do with your malpractice company. You have to at least let them know, whether no matter what may happen or occur later on. But that was just with everything with the girls and just that, and I just I was starting to getting up in the middle of the night taking drinks, and in the morning taking a shot before I would leave the house. And then it got to where even on the way would take a shot. And I was getting also I was at when I was left the office, I didn't drink while I was in the office. That's one thing I didn't do, but there were times I shouldn't have been in there. And so anyway, I had an anonymous complaint to the State Board of Dentistry, and that was the beginning of the that was the beginning of my recovery. That I realized that the State Board inspector came in, and I told her everything. I said, I'm an alcoholic, and I went to rehab back in 2010, and I do all this, and I didn't realize, but that all goes in your record, and it's all for public. Everybody can read that. That's on, that's nothing you're going to get rid of. Anyway, I went home that night. I remember it said State Board Inspector came today. And so I talked to her, told her everything. So, man, that's it. I'm glad I got rid of the State Board. Well, when that happens, I said, I'm going next week. I'm headed to Farley Rehab Center in Williamsburg. And 9/11, never forget it, 9/11, 2017. Wife's taking me to the driving to Williamsburg, and she says, "You think I'm taking you to an execution or two, don't you?" And I said, "Yes." And actually, she was taking me to save my life. And now, when that happens, when a practitioner in the state of Virginia, when that happens, if you go into a facility like that, they notify the state board. Of course, I already had, the state board was investigating me for anonymous complaint. So anyway, ends up a consent order that my license is suspended, but I have to go into this program. It's a state program called Virginia Health Practitioners Monitoring Program. And if I go into this program, then my license will be, what they say, stayed, the suspension stayed, and I can practice. Well, little did I know what was about to ensue for the next 4.5 years. I spent 10 weeks in Farley, got out, and then I, first meeting out, I remember, was at Westminster. Thursday, it was Thanksgiving morning, the Friends of Bill W., and that was my first meeting, and I will never forget that. I was required by the board to do 3 meetings a week. That was one of the requirements. There's many more. And one of our friends comes up to me and says, "Now, Jim," he says, "we have a meeting tonight that you can come to. And I said, you know, I didn't even want to, I only have to do 3 a week. You want me to do 2 in 1 day? That's crazy. Anyway, that was the beginning of my metamorphosis. That's where I started changing. The whole thing, and seeing that people like you in this room, that there was hope there. And the monitoring board would not let me go work for 7 months. My office was, I had another dentist in there, but it was a disaster. So they would not let me go back to work. So I had a time to work on my recovery program. I was doing at least five meetings a week. I had a group meeting that I had to do in Virginia Beach, and then I had a professional Caduceus, what we call Caduceus meeting. And then I was being drug screened also, probably once every 10 days or so. So plus a monthly report. And finally I get back to practice. I go to for about 2 months. And then a friend of mine is in June. This is another faithful part in my life here. In June, a friend of mine says, Jim, can you go up to the National Guard base in Blackstone and help get these soldiers ready for duty? And I said, sure. And did not get permission from a monitoring board. Well, I came back from that. I called my caseworker up. I said, look, I went up to help a friend. And anyway, she said, you know, that's non-compliance, that's without permission. So 1 week later, June 12th, I'll never forget this, in a span of about 1 hour, my caseworker tells me that I'm dismissed from the program. So that means my license goes into suspension, cannot, and I have to close my office again. A newspaper reporter from the Virginia Pilot calls and say, hey, we're running a story on you, that you had made a deal with State Board of Dentistry going into this program so that you could practice. And do you have any comment? And then about an hour later, I'm getting served by my malpractice company that I had not been forthright with them for the past 10 years. So they're what they call a rescission of my coverage, going all the way back to 2010 when I went into the first rehab and back in 2010. So I had those three things to do, you know, and man, let's go home and let's start drinking. But, you know, that's what, you know, something is disastrous of that in one day. And I didn't. I was able to maintain my, you know, and I knew that if I wanted to get out of this situation, if I ever wanted to practice dentistry again, that I could not take a drink. And so the next 7 months, office is closed, and it's just I had time to work on my program again, you know, and that's where one of the things I was talking about in our meeting with Sermon on the Mount, if you know anything about that, that's kind of the precepts of Christianity, and one is blessed are those who mourn for the kingdom of heaven is theirs. So that's basically giving up your free will to God. And so I was sharing something about that, and one of our esteemed members, Buster Hawkins, came up to me and he gave me this book here, Sermon on the Mount, The Keys to Success in Life. Anyway, by Emmett Fox. If you know anything about Emmett Fox, he was a metaphysical writer in the 30s. And he gave Bill Wilson and Dr. Bob a lot of their ideas of, and actually gave this book out into AA in 1934 before, and that was given out before the A book in 1939. So they got a lot of their ideas from this Emmett Fox, who I kind of became a disciple of. Anyway, Let's see. So finally, I get my license back again, 2019. That's another. So my office, and since I when I went to Farley in 2017, basically had been closed almost 14 months, and I just I couldn't sustain it. I was just, you know, it was just very difficult to maintain operating in the office. And then 2020 comes, COVID, and I'm out. I have to close down another 4 months. So I'm kind of running on fumes. And we go, you know, we go back to work. I guess it was around June, July, 2020, when the state said we could go back to work. So I go January 2021. And again, I mean, I'm just like, I'm financially, I'm strapped. And so there was an opportunity for me for a dentist that was undergoing cancer treatment in Suffolk, and locum tenens, which is temporary fill-in. And so I had the paperwork in with my caseworker or the people up in Richmond, and unfortunately everything wasn't completely signed in the way it should be. I went to work for this fellow for a couple weeks, and you know, they found out. And again, I was dismissed from the program. And so that was, I had to close my office again. This is 20, yeah, okay. So anyway, we're coming down to the end here. So we're at 2021, closed down, no, and so the state board, they said, we're not going to let you, we're not going to give you, stay your suspension unless you get back in the program. And the monitoring board said, we're not going to let you get your license until you have a hearing in front of us. So I was in a catch 22. So it ended up, even after all the discussions, you have to go in front of a formal hearing of the State Board of Dentistry in December, past December. And they ruled that that unanimously in my favor that I could go back into the program, into the monitoring program. And that's where I am now. So I'm back in the program. I lost my office. You know, my landlord could only go so far after 30 that I hadn't paid the rent, and they just closed the office. So I lost my office. I've lost my office and everything that was in it. It's only been by the grace of many people that I've had that have helped me. And that's two of the most influential people in my program in the last 4 years are in this program. And I can't tell you, one, Alan has been my professional mentor, and then there's another one in here that I'm not supposed to mention his name, but he's he's in the back of the room, and he has been so influential in my program also. I still do 3 meetings a week. I'm getting drug tested. My report. So things are turning around. I have gotten a position that in a corporate dentistry in Hampton. Hopefully that will start in just a few weeks, without all the administrative part, and where I can just do dentistry. And I just want to, you know, you've learned that, you know, you're to do God's will. And I wish I had some more time, but I'm getting the cutthroat here. Anyway, I just wanted to leave you that, you know, to do God's will, to be like a pencil in God's hand, and let Him do the writing and let Him do the thinking. And there's a book here that I read, 10 prayers that God will always answer yes to. And one of them is to show me your please, God, show me my destiny. And if you do God's will, if you do let him guide you. You know, we're like pencils, like I said, and we're going to break and we're going to get dull, and we need to be sharpened. You know, that's why we get some of these trials and tribulations in our life. We're being sharpened up. And perseverance. God loves perseverance in us. And every one of you all in here have had your trials and tribulations and gone through them and have spoken up here and shared them with the rest. I just wanted this one paragraph that I had, and I'll leave you with this. And I'm sorry I kind of rambled on. I did the best I can. But I just want to leave this. And I think this is so pertinent to what I just said. So how does a person get right with God? By doing all the things we've talked about in this book. By trusting in the Lord and having faith in Him. Faith. By trying to be obedient to His commands. By repenting when you fall. By having a spirit of thankfulness for all the blessings you've received, especially the gift of life. By being prayerful instead of prideful, humble instead of arrogant. By dedicating your life to serving others, just as God took on human form so that He could serve us. In short, by being in union with God. That was my metamorphosis, my metanoia, and thank you for letting me be here.